Hello, and welcome to Season 3 of Medical Women Talking. I'm Jane Dacre, and in this season, I wanted to speak to more wonderful and inspiring medical women, including people who are early and mid-career. These women are all making a name for themselves in their respective fields. They're what I like to call rising stars, and will be influencing all our futures.
Today, I'm talking to Abby Patel. Abby's a consultant surgeon at Coventry. She's in the early phase of her consultant career, but remarkably, she's got two young children and she's aspiring to be a leader in surgery. So welcome, Abby.
Thank you.
So Abby, let's start by you telling me how you got to where you are.
It was a very long journey. So if you want, I'll start from the beginning. So I think I essentially came from a fairly humble background, and I think it was my father who recognised the value of education and really sort of infused enthusiasm amongst us to sort of aspire to be our best. So I started off in inner city Birmingham and then managed to secure a place in a grammar school nearby, which really opened up opportunity for me that I probably wouldn't have had otherwise. And then on the back of that, I secured a post at and got a place at Cambridge to do medicine. Wow.
So that's pretty impressive. So were you the first person in your family to go to university?
So actually, both my parents went to university, but they went to university in India. And my dad did organic chemistry and had a dream of being a doctor and never quite made the grades and never really secured a place. And then he emigrated before he could do anything with it. And his degree here wasn't recognised. So he couldn't get a job which would recognise his degree. So I think his lifelong ambition was always to be a doctor himself. And I still remember the first time he sort of introduced that idea of being a doctor was when I was 7 years old at a parents' evening. And he turned around to the teacher and said, "Do you think she's clever enough to be a doctor?" And this poor teacher looked back and said, "I'm not really sure because she's only seven." And I think that seed sort of stayed and lingered in the back of my mind, you know, through most of my schooling. And I got to GCSEs, did the GCSEs and thought, do I really want to do medicine or is it just something that I'm going along with?
Some people might have seen that sort of parenting as pressure and reacted against it.
Yeah, so I sort of did a little bit in that first year of A-levels. I kind of went off and sort of really critically analysed what my interests were. And at the time, I remember enjoying physics way more than biology or chemistry. And so I looked at engineering and I looked at it quite closely and I compared engineering with medicine. I did quite a lot of work experience and went out and spoke to people and saw what they actually did. And the thing that tipped it for me was basically the idea that in medicine you work with people on all at different levels. And I realized I wasn't one of those people that could sit at a desk and work on my own very well. Even, you know, later on working in a lab, I always sort of struggled with doing things on my own. And, you know, it would be fun if there were other people in the lab, but I'd hate to be the only person in the lab. So I realized very quickly that it was that people contact that was going to keep me interested and was going to fulfill me way more than a career in engineering could have supplied.
Right. And so you carried on at Cambridge. How did that go? Did you enjoy it?
So I think the other thing to mention is that around that time, I actually went through something quite difficult. I lost my mum at the age of 44. So she sadly died. And that was a few months before I was due to sit my final exams for my A-levels. So it was a terrible time to have to go through it any time in your life, but a particularly terrible time because it was sort of the turning point between leaving home and going off to become independent. I think somehow as a family, we sort of got, you know, found some courage and strength from somewhere. And I managed to get through the exams and go off to university. And then at university, I essentially just threw myself into all the activities that it offered. It was a slightly different environment to the one I'd been in before, and a little bit of a culture shock, I think, to sort of go in from, you know, being in inner city Birmingham to being in Cambridge. It's a very different environment. So that required some transition, I think. But I enjoyed Cambridge very much. I really had a good time, made loads of friends, did lots and lots of activities outside of medicine, met people who weren't just doing medicine. So, you know, interacted with lawyers, historians, you know, it opened up opportunity that, again, I probably wouldn't have had in another setting.
Gosh, so quite a culture shock. I mean, there are some people who, with all of those stresses on them, would have gone into a crazy spiral, but you managed not to.
No. Yes. I think it's recognizing that you've got support around yourself to help you. It was support provided by family throughout, but also the fact that you have some inbuilt resilience to get you through it. And somehow, you know, the work ethic and sort of conscientiousness and you know, it was a unique opportunity for me. I hadn't thought I was ever going to apply to Cambridge. I sort of got sort of sidetracked into it by the school. You know, school sort of said, oh, it'd be a good idea for you to apply. Why don't you think about applying? And I sort of went along with it thinking I'll just satisfy them and they'll be happy if I just apply. And then I got a place, and I actually wanted to go to Leeds, I think, at the time.
Fantastic.
And, you know, turned around and said, no, you have to go to Cambridge because you got in.
Right. What a great achievement. Yeah, what a great achievement. So when did you decide that you are now in surgery? When did you decide that surgery was the specialty for you? Because you're clearly not somebody that gets frightened off by high bars and high barriers.
No, so actually, I think I'm somebody who goes and looks for the high bars and high barriers, to be honest. I tend to go for things that are more difficult and challenging. I can't really explain why, but I've always done that. I think for me, surgery is different to medicine in the respect that it offers you the opportunity to, what I like to say to a lot of my juniors is, fix people. You know, you take somebody who's really ill, who's coming with either a trauma or something like that, and you do an operation which restores them back to their normal self. So it's about that restoration. And I found that that was the most satisfying part of surgery that I was drawn to, you know, the ability to really heal people and not manage a condition, but actually cure a condition. And that was what was unique for me. And at the time I intercalated in neurophysiology. So I wanted to do neurosurgery. And I started off really aspiring to be a neurosurgeon and threw everything at it. And I went off to Oxford after my house jobs to spend 6 months at the old Radcliffe Infirmary before it closed. And I still remember I was living in outpatients because they'd closed outpatients and they'd have rooms up at the top of outpatients. So I was actually living in the hospital and then working in the hospital at the same time. So it was really bizarre sort of experience to go through. And in that 6 months, I did 3 months. And there are still 2 consultations in that 6 months that really pivoted me towards general surgery. So one was a 14-year-old boy who was diagnosed with a pontine glioma, which was incurable. And I remember sitting with the consultant neurosurgeon for at least an hour talking about the diagnosis with his family and walking away from it. And I think it was the first consultation in my career where I walked away and I actually cried after that consultation. It was heartbreaking process to go through. And for the neurosurgeon, it was a helpless situation to be in. And then the second patient that comes to mind is a young gentleman who had a skull-based tumour operated on and consequently became blind, deaf and unable to communicate. And he'd been on a ventilator for a very long period of time. And I remember going into his room to do some kind of a medical procedure and looking at this photograph that was on his bedside table, which basically was him when he was well, trekking up a mountain. And it was astonishing to see that we had reduced this very healthy and well person to a fraction of his former self. And I think both of those experiences basically highlighted that the burden of morbidity is quite huge, which I hadn't previously been exposed to. Whereas in general surgery, there are lots and lots of different options if there are complications to be able to salvage the situation and cause less patient harm. So I think for me, that was the sort of the tipping point. I moved away from neurosurgery into general surgery based on sort of the clinical experience I'd had rather than what I had perceived both of those careers what they would have represented.
So when you went back into general surgery, did it feel different?
No, it didn't, in the sense that I think general surgery is different in neurosurgery, not just from sort of the patient experience, but also from the training perspective. So it's hands-on from a very early stage. And it was actually one of the colorectal surgeons I worked with in Cambridge who'd always spent time sort of saying to me, you know, you've got small hands, you can definitely operate very well in the pelvis. You should definitely do general surgery. Don't do neurosurgery. And that kept ringing in my head when I went into general surgery as sort of a positive. And I carried on and I've enjoyed it every minute since then.
So did your career go seamlessly from that change then? You became a consultant relatively easily?
I don't think I'd say it was relatively easily. I think it was a very long road. So standard sort of registrar training is 6 years and I took 12. So I almost doubled it. And in that 12 years, I had two children, did an MD, did a master's in medical education and worked less than full time. So I packed in quite a lot in that extra time. But I think it was time well spent. And I think that the sort of a lot of trainees coming through now are in a hurry to get to the end. And actually, it's a lot about the journey that you go on to get to the end or what you perceive to be the end. And it's important that you do go off and do things that are interesting to you and not just get focused on the clinical training, because that's going to be a large chunk of what you do for the rest of your life.
Yeah. So now that you're a consultant, is it all that you hoped it would be? Because, I mean, certainly one hears a lot about difficulties that particularly young women have in surgery with behaviours and bullying and inappropriate things happening to them. Have you noticed those sorts of things, or is it not as bad as people say?
So I think the experience people have is very variable. So it's not that it's the same across the board. I think for me, when I first became a consultant, it was a great sense of achievement. You know, you get to the end of the road, you think you've got there. And the feeling was very much that I've got to the end, I can do my job, people will perceive me as that. And what I actually found was that sometimes you would have sort of discouragement from colleagues, sometimes you could have patients questioning whether you are the surgeon who's going to operate on them. And I found that the patients and sort of other health professionals I encountered often didn't perceive me as the general surgeon. You know, they didn't think of me as the person who was going to go in and operate on them. And that I found more difficult because it wasn't something I was expecting. I think you go through training and, you know, some of the harassment and some of the misogyny, it still exists. But you sort of think, well, I'll get to the end. Once I get to the end, I've proven that I can achieve and I am who I am and I'm a surgeon. But actually, you become the consultant and you're still almost having to still do the same. You're still having to prove yourself every single time. And I do think the bar is set higher for female surgeons often than it is for male surgeons. I think they have to work harder to prove that they have equivalent, if not better, outcomes than their peers. And I think it's recognizing that and not holding everything inside and thinking that it's a reflection and you're unable to do those things. I think you have to recognize that you are on the same bar as everybody else.
So how do you handle it when those sort of undermining comments come? What do you do?
So, I mean, there have been times where I would be lying if I said I didn't get angry. I had emails that say, "Dear Mr. Patel," and sometimes it's quite grating. I am the only female surgeon in the department in general surgery. So I can sort of understand that they may assume that all of them are male surgeons. It's also frustrating. You often go into meetings and you know, if I walked in with a male colleague into a meeting in general surgery, the assumption would be that, you know, the male colleague is a general surgeon and I'm not a general surgeon. I think that perception hasn't changed, and it can be frustrating. But I think equally, I've had instances where patients have turned around and said, are you sure you're going to be the one doing the operation? And, you know, I would really like you to do the operation. And you sort of see that, you build those relationships. And that in itself is fulfilling. So it counters some of the negative experiences that you have.
Excellent. So you've also now done quite a lot of work and quite a lot of thinking about encouraging other women into surgery. Do you think your experiences influence that?
I think they do. I like to think of my training, especially as a surgical registrar, sort of before and after less than full-time training. So before less than full-time training, I didn't really have any role models or mentors, and I didn't really know how I was going to navigate the whole path. And then I had 2 years out to do research. And after I came back from research, I went into less than full-time training, and I did 3 years in three different hospitals, two of which were job shared with a more senior colleague. And it was that senior colleague who provided sort of informal peer mentorship during that sort of transition phase. And she was invaluable in helping me get through that training. And subsequently, I think in every job I did thereafter, I identified a role model or a mentor, and that really helped to sort of shape my training and my experience. But also, you know, surgery can be quite difficult and challenging and hard. And in those situations, you really do need somebody you can pick up the phone to and have a chat. And it helped me to identify those people. So, you know, my general sort of advice to people coming through the other end and becoming newly appointed consultants is build a network of people who can really help you get through some difficult days, because we're all going to encounter them.
Yeah, that's very true, isn't it? And that's what all of us need to do. But being a woman, there can't have been that many other female mentors that you could that you could go to. I suppose men can mentor you too.
Yes, and I'd say that I was sort of reflecting on who my mentors have been, and there were essentially two male surgeons and three female surgeons who I'd probably say were mentors. So yes, men and women can mentor. I don't think it's gender specific. I think it's the ability to understand the demands of the job and the demands of your personal life. And you can be a man or a woman, as long as you understand both of those things and you can balance them, you can help the trainee get through a difficult training path.
Excellent. Yeah, I think that's true. So do you want to mention some highs and then maybe some lows of your career so far?
So my highs are probably getting to the end. I can tell you 12 years in, it is difficult. And everybody who started behind you has raced ahead. And although it's not a race, it can feel like that sometimes. So I saw an SHO I trained to do appendicectomy become a consultant before I did. So it's realizing and recognizing that you're in for the long game, not for the short game. And not losing sight of that. I think that the other high is that I specialized in an area which I'm very passionate about. I specialized in inflammatory bowel disease, which means I look after lots of young patients. I find that deeply satisfying. You have a long-term relationship with them and you navigate their chronic illness with everything that brings, you know, every challenge that their life brings. So you talk to women with Crohn's disease who are about to go off and have a baby, and you try and understand those implications. So I essentially love the job I do, which keeps me going, I think. And then I think that outside of work, I've really tried to focus on building mentorship opportunities for people and really acting as a role model to try and inspire people to take on a job in surgery. I think it, you know, if I was very much an introvert, and I probably still am in heart, and I think it's important that people recognize you don't have to be a particular type of model or a person to be a surgeon. You know, surgeons come in all shapes and sizes, and we should embrace that, not try and put people into little boxes and say you don't get the box. I think that's really important.
So have you, do you think you've had any particular lows or any barriers that you've overcome that you would feel comfortable to share?
Well, I think that when I read the paper on sexual harassment and misogyny and comments that have been made, I can think of many times in my training career where I've met people who've had certain prejudices and have made it difficult to succeed. And I think it's important that we do talk about it and we sort of move the conversation from the barriers to the facilitators, which we need to focus on now. I think that the case has been made that there are many barriers and women face them all through their training and often leave. So I think retention of trainees in the surgical training scheme is very important. And I think the facilitators are really, you know, support networks, role models, mentors, being comfortable about talking about the barriers and finding, you know, real pragmatic solutions to try and address them. So for me, the barrier was the perception, you know, there's the barrier of other what other people think you are, but also what you think you are. So, you know, first 6 months of being a consultant, I think I suffered quite terribly about imposter syndrome. I sort of was walking around going, I'm not really the surgeon. Am I the surgeon? Oh, okay, I am the surgeon and I am supposed to do this. Okay, I can think I can do it. So it was that, you know, the first 6 months of the uncertainty and not really being confident in the shoes that you're wearing. And that, you know, we don't provide any formal support to newly appointed consultants in that sort of a situation. So it's looking at seeing where there are sort of gaps and where we need to be more holistic in how we provide support to newly appointed consultants, but also trainees in difficulty, trainees who are coming back after maternity leave, trainees who have come out of research, you know, all of those transitions we'd sort of take for granted. They are transitions and they need to be supported.
So during your career, you've talked about how you've been helped enormously by mentors. What else has helped you, if you think more broadly about actually how well you've done? What's helped you along your way?
I think it's partly mentors. It's partly family. You know, I have a very supportive husband who basically looked after my two young boys when they were younger for 6 months whilst I'd sat my FRCS. So it's family support, it's peer support, and it's mentorship. It's also role models. It's sitting in the audience and seeing somebody on the podium who reflects who you are. I think the power of that is not measurable. You know, I think if you can see somebody like yourself who's sitting there and has reached where you might want to reach, it really does enthuse you to actually carry on. And I think that that's invaluable. So I think that all the work that's being done currently to try and improve equality and diversity amongst, you know, all organizations is actually very, very important, because it opens up the field, you know, it opens up doors that people think have traditionally been closed to them.
So how do you think being a successful female doctor has influenced your personal life? You mentioned that your husband is very supportive. Do you think there's been an impact?
I think there's definitely been an impact. I often have trainees come up to me and ask, how can you have a family and can you have children whilst you become a surgeon? And I think that you can. I think that the difficulty is understanding that you can't do it all. And at some points in your training or your career, you may focus more on your family. And in some points, the balance will tip the other way. And I think it is an important but difficult balance to maintain. So I don't think it's impossible that you can do both. I do think that there have been times when my children were younger where I didn't have the opportunity to spend time with them. And actually, it was the COVID pandemic where I really actually recognized that. So during the COVID pandemic, I was doing my fellowship in Oxford. And for the first time, my husband was working harder than I was. he was working all hours in the day because he's a GP, and they were doing lots of virtual consultations. And I was not needed on quite a few of the days in Oxford. So I was spending it at home with my boys doing homeschooling and taking them for bike rides. And it was the first time, I think, since becoming a doctor and since having the children that I realized how much time I hadn't spent with them and how valuable that time was. And for COVID, for a lot of people, I think helped to reaffirm work-life balance, not just in medicine, but in all careers, because it focused people into work, you know, and made them work from home, which is something that a lot of people didn't do before the COVID pandemic. So for me, it was a real turning point. And when I became a consultant 6 months later, I had the ability to control what was in my diary. So for the first time since my oldest is now 12 years old, I pick them up from school twice a week, which I never did when I was training because I never finished on time.
That must make a huge difference. I've heard one of the women that I've spoken to saying, well, you can have it all, but maybe not all at the same time. And I think that's what you're talking about. So we're coming to the end now. And I was just wondering whether you had one or two pearls of wisdom. Now that obviously there's been a lot of pearls as we've been talking today, but one or two things that you feel would be important to say to women that are listening to this podcast who perhaps aspire to be like you, who are looking at you on the podcast podium and saying, I want to be like her.
I'm not sure you want to be like me, but generally speaking, I'd say surgery is a very rewarding, challenging and thought-provoking career. I think it offers you the ability to connect with your patients in a very, very unique way. And in doing so, you have to establish a lot of trust and rapport. And although surgeons don't have the best reputation for being empathetic and compassionate, I think that it's actually very important that you have those things as attributes. So I think that women in surgery will really bring that. I think it will help to change the balance from being sort of very much, you know, we're going to do an operation and we're going to do this, to actually looking at the patient as a whole. So it'll help make surgery more holistic. I think if you want to pursue a career in surgery, I think those are all the benefits of pursuing a career in surgery, but it is a hard and a long road, and it can be unforgiving at times. You can feel exposed at times, and it can be quite tough. So in order to get you through that, I think you need a certain amount of resilience and tenacity. You certainly need support to help you get through it. You need some of those role models to aspire to, and you need the mentors and a network of support around you who you can pick the phone up to and say, how do I deal with this? And I think it's important that we as a surgical workforce are more kind and compassionate and supportive to our colleagues. And I think it's something that surgeons are terribly bad at doing, is talking about burnout and stress and all of those things that impact everybody in every walk of life. But surgeons tend to have to feel this pressure to have a tough exterior, but actually we're all human. So I think it's a rewarding career, but it's tough and challenging. So you spend your time really thinking about it and spend your time researching it, and don't give up at the first hurdle.
Fantastic. Well, you certainly make me feel like I should have been a surgeon, and I hope that you inspire a lot of younger women coming through to do the same thing. Abby, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.